Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come, join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs.
Will the breath of the living be snuffed out by the hand of darkness? The monster lives in death.
Get out of this room.
Boris Karloff, never before more demoniacal.
The Haunted Drive-In is packed tonight, Projectionist. A double feature of Reanimator, and now 1965's Die, Monster, Die with Boris Karloff. Those were two fantastic choices.
Naturally, Victor. That is why I handle the programming here, yes?
Sure.
What would you have chosen for a second feature after 1985's Reanimator?
I don't know. Maybe From Beyond. Or what about The Unnameable? Actually, now that I think about it, we could have started with Die, Monster, Die, and then shown Richard Stanley's Color Out of Space. I mean, the 1965 movie was loosely based off that particular Lovecraft story, right?
That is correct, Sage. Perhaps your time spent with me is beginning to rub off, eh? That is not a bad idea for a double feature, after all. Given enough time, you might make a crackerjack projectionist yourself.
Well, I think at my age, and the fact that modern theaters have all but done away with film, that is not going to happen, my friend. Speaking of film, though, earlier this evening, when visiting Rockford J in the concession stand, he said that the original film prints you obtained for Night Gallery were shipped back to that private collector this afternoon.
Ah, excellent news.
Speak of the devil. Hey, Rockford, I was just telling the projectionist that you sent off the original prints for those Night Gallery episodes we screened earlier this week. Is everything okay?
Absolutely, Vic. I was just about to finish closing up the concession stand before catching Die, Monster, Die.
Have the fryers been scrubbed, intern Rockford J?
Yes, projectionist. Although why we have those fryers, I will never figure out. The Haunted Drive-In concession menu doesn't even offer anything we would need to deep fry.
It is for employees who question how I run the Haunted Drive-In, intern Rockford J. I find that if I take their...
Hey! Look at the recording light on the control panel, projectionist.
Questions to heart. I can improve the experience at the Haunted Drive-In, yes? Welcome, dear listeners, to a new Saturday Frights radio broadcast. Victor and I were just taking a moment to speak with intern Rockford J.
The projectionist was just telling Rockford what an amazing job he does, and how excited he is to give our friend a raise in pay, since he's no longer an intern. Isn't that right?
Yes, that is exactly what I was about to say, dear boy. Perhaps we ought to get to the subject of this radio broadcast, though.
Good idea, man. Rockford, you were at the screening of the Night Gallery episode. That wasn't the first time you saw Cool Air, the 1971 segment that adapted H.P. Lovecraft's story of the same name, was it?
No, actually it wasn't, Vic. The first time I saw the Cool Air segment of Night Gallery was when I was a junior or senior in high school. A local TV station had started showing reruns of the show on weeknights at midnight or 1 o'clock, I forget which, but I, at that time, had discovered that I was the night owl of the family, and it wasn't uncommon for me to stay up past what was traditionally my bedtime to watch whatever I might be able to find, and when those Night Gallery repeats started to air, I was really interested because I knew that Night Gallery was, to some degree, Rod Serling's show, and I had become a huge fan of The Twilight Zone by then. Night Gallery is a bit of an uneven show, as its reputation suggests, but the segments that I enjoyed the most, I discovered, were the segments that were adaptations that Rod Serling had written of other people's work, including especially the H.P. Lovecraft adaptations that he did for Night Gallery. And Cool Air is far and away my favorite. I think it is one of the best segments in the entire run of the show, and is in fact my second favorite of all the segments of Night Gallery. I think it is beautifully written. The dialogue is a little bit florid, but very literate and very beautifully delivered by the actors, Barbara Rush and Henry Darrow especially. The direction is really cinematic. There's some gorgeous lighting, and the soundtrack is something special. The score is very unusual for network television at the time and very memorable. And the whole segment has not only a horror quality, but also a sadness about it, an elegiac quality that sort of shadows the entire segment of the show, which culminates at the end in a way that's very satisfying and very memorable. And when I tell people that Night Gallery is a show they should check out, Cool Air is always one of the two or three segments that I'm thinking about.
Rockford, thank you for sharing that, man.
My pleasure, Vic. I'm going to close up now and go enjoy Die, Monster, Die. Thank you again, Projectionist. It'll be nice to actually be paid now.
We will discuss the matter further tomorrow, Intern Rockford. Rockford J. Come find me tomorrow afternoon. We can have a quiet moment to ourselves. A whole lot of time to talk about your new career at the Haunted Drive-In.
I look forward to it, Projectionist. Vic, I'll see you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Rockford. I know that Preston Griffith down in the Vault Library said we have a shipment of power records we need to catalog. Hey, maybe we'll get a chance to listen to some of them while we work.
Sounds good. Good luck with the show.
Get some sleep, Rockford J. Now then, Victor, as we have discussed on episodes of Night Gallery in the past, I must assume that you first saw Cool Air on this WTBS superstation you have spoken of so much.
That would be a good guess, my friend, but in this case, you'd be mistaken. I most certainly did see more than a few Night Gallery episodes, either very late or very early on WTBS in my youth, and while I was fortunate to see what was the pilot for the series at the 62 Drive-In, I was able to enjoy the majority of Night Gallery episodes on VHS, thanks to the Columbia House, in fact.
The mail order company, yes?
Yeah, you know, the old 13 records or tapes for just $1 company? After I had graduated high school and was working full-time at the video store...
Yes. Your first foray into the business of motion pictures.
Well, the second video store in this case. My first job was at a wonderful mom-and-pop type of store. After a couple of years working there, I was hired by another local video store, although it was a chain in this case. Anyway, I was making enough money at that time, I signed up for the service. I started with The Prisoner, actually, but since there are only 17 episodes, by the time I had received the last one of those, they had made Night Gallery available.
So they would send you a VHS tape. You would send them remittance, and they would send you another VHS tape?
Sort of. They would send only one tape a month. The bill would be attached to the packaging for the tape. Now and again, say during the holidays, one might end up letting a payment slip a month or so. I can tell you that with my group of friends, as I've mentioned before, I was the die-hard horror fan of the group. There was only one other that would be kind enough to show up after work at my house, and we would watch nearly every single Night Gallery tape together. That is a fond memory, to say the very least. At the time we sat down to watch Cool Air, we were both very familiar with the works of H.P. Lovecraft, even if we hadn't read that particular story as of yet. We both kind of freaked out when we saw it was going to be another Lovecraft adaptation, especially since the tape before had contained Pickman's model. However, in the case with Cool Air, the teleplay for the adaptation was handled by none other than Rod Serling.
Indeed, and while Pickman's model is entertaining, the emotional punch of the horror of Cool Air could only be delivered by the likes of Rod Serling.
Obviously, I would agree, Projectionist. Although Night Gallery may not be celebrated quite as much as Serling's Twilight Zone, and perhaps for good reason, the truth is, there are many fantastic episodes of Night Gallery.
Do you know, by chance, dear boy, when H.P. Lovecraft's Cool Air was originally published, and where?
I have no clue, Projectionist. Was it in Weird Tales or something?
No! As a matter of fact, it was rejected by that periodical. While we do not know the true reason that this particular story was rejected by Weird Tales, there have been some that have assumed it might have had to do with the tale's rather gruesome ending.
Well, it is a pretty memorable end to the story, and not surprising, they went with a little different direction on the Night Gallery episode. Sort of.
H.P. Lovecraft wrote Cool Air in March of 1926, while he was in New York City, a time it would appear the author was feeling most displeased with elements of his life. I say elements as he moved with his wife, Sonia Green, to Brooklyn 2 years earlier. Her feelings were that he had to expand his horizons, that his writing would benefit from getting away from Providence, Rhode Island. The story, however, was originally published in the pages of the March 1928 issue of Tales of Magic and Mystery.
I believe I read something about Sonia Green supporting Lovecraft's desire to become a professional writer. Green herself was a writer. The two actually became acquainted when they both attended a press convention for novice writers that was being held in Boston in 1921. Green would even have one of her stories, The Horror at Martin's Beach, published in the November 1923 issue of Weird Tales. A story, I should add, that was edited by Lovecraft, and he also changed the title to The Invisible Monster. Personally, I think that the original title was the better one.
As do I.
Sonia had her own business, so Lovecraft could stay in their apartment and write during the day, to say nothing of going out and exploring at night. Lovecraft appears to have greatly enjoyed walks around Brooklyn after dark, often with friends like George Willard Kirk, who, by the way, was a bookseller. So, no surprise there why the two became friends. In fact, the townhouse from Lovecraft's story is actually based on the place where Kirk had lived back in 1925.
That is correct, Victor. However, the truth of the matter is that even with Sonia Green and his circle of friends for support, Lovecraft missed Providence, Rhode Island. Then, through a series of bad fortunes, Sonia Green lost her business and, worst of all, became ill. I have heard tell that H.P. Lovecraft felt the need to naturally care for his wife and set out to secure a job so that he could support the two of them. This did not pan out, as the author found his life so far had ill afforded him the opportunities to develop the skills that would have landed him steady employment. Victor, I am sure you understand how H.P. Lovecraft felt, yes?
Thanks, Projectionist. I will kindly remind you that my unemployment at the arcade is in the long run a brief situation. But yes, I will admit finding a job after a lifetime in the hospitality industry is proving harder than expected. Back to the subject, though. Lovecraft, as it turned out, was offered a position as editor at Weird Tales magazine, but he turned it down, as he didn't relish the idea of moving to Chicago.
One cannot help but ponder what might have been if H.P. Lovecraft had agreed to that editorial position.
Totally, man. Thankfully, Sonya did get better. She did have to move first to Cincinnati and then to Cleveland to find employment, which resulted in Lovecraft having to move to an apartment in the northwestern neighborhood of Brooklyn known as Red Hook.
And it was here that H.P. Lovecraft wrote Cool Air, as well as The Horror at Red Hook and He. Not to mention the beginnings, the outline of what would become The Call of Kalalu.
Wait, is that how it's actually pronounced?
According to Lovecraft himself, it is, dear boy. It is meant to be a guttural sounding name.
Huh. When I first started reading Lovecraft, I just pronounced it as Cthulhu. And then later, Cthulhu. That's interesting. Well, eventually, after Lovecraft moved back to Providence, Rhode Island, Sonya Green and HP, who had been separated due to work and such, both agreed that it best to end their marriage and filed for divorce. Although, as it was eventually revealed after Lovecraft's passing, he never actually signed the termination of marriage by the time he passed away in 1937. Which, as you can imagine, in 1945 came as quite a shock to Sonya, who had remarried in 1936 after moving to California. To her dismay, she found all of this out, including Lovecraft's death 8 years after the fact.
It was a different time, Sage, and while it has been argued that H.P. Lovecraft himself, when he died on March 17th of 1937, probably considered his mark on the world as minuscule, as his only published book, The Shadow Over Innsmouth, and the short stories published in the likes of Weird Tales, or, as I have already said, with Cool Air, in the pages of Tales of Magic and Mystery. But we are still talking about his work, whether that be with adaptations from episodes of Night Gallery to films such as Reanimator and Dagon, to name a few. His legacy, as it would become evident, was in the circle of fellow writers and friends he cultivated during his time. August Derleth, Robert Bloch, Clark Ashton Smith, and others. The Lovecraft Circle. It was they that helped to keep his work alive.
Very well said, Projectionist. While we aren't exactly going to jump into the synopsis for the Night Gallery adaptation of Cool Air just yet, I want to just go ahead and state that Rod Serling did something very intelligent with his teleplay. Not just using Lovecraft's story of two men becoming friends. After all, in the original story, the narrator, a writer by trade, suffers a heart attack, and the mysterious Dr. Munoz not only saves his life, but acts as a mentor. From the story itself, quote, he sought to distract my mind from my own seizure by speaking of his theories and experiments, and I remember his tactfully consoling me about my weak heart by insisting that will and consciousness are stronger than organic life itself, so that if a body frame be but originally healthy and carefully preserved, it may through a scientific enhancement of these qualities retain a kind of nervous animation, despite the most serious impairments, defects, or even absences in the battery of specific organs. He might, he half jestingly said, someday teach me to live, or at least to possess some kind of conscious existence without any heart at all. End quote. Serling changed it so that Night Gallery's Cool Air is a love story, a tragic one at that. And in my opinion, it makes it far easier to feel something for the characters of both Dr. Juan Munoz, played by Henry Darrow, and Barbara Rush's character of Agatha Howard. Of course, it does help the episode that it has two very talented performers, like Darrow and Rush. The latter might be familiar to all of you Fright fans for her work in 1951's When Worlds Collide, It Came from Outer Space, or possibly her stint in the popular Peyton Place TV series. Henry Darrow is an actor I was first introduced to thanks to his role as Trooper Hancock in 1986's The Hitcher, where he starred along with the late and great Rutger Hauer and C. Thomas Howell, as well as Jennifer Jason Leigh. In addition, he had a long-running role in the daytime soap opera Santa Barbara, as well as Don Alejandro de la Vega in the Family Channel's Zorro TV series. The two actors have an amazing chemistry together, and while Cool Air moves at a brisk pace, with a running time around 26 minutes, you totally buy into the fact that Dr. Munoz and Agatha have fallen in love, and the darker implications when you step back and realize what that means for Rush's character. More on that in just a bit.
Do not forget the rather haunting melody provided by Robert Bain as the character of Dr. Juan Munoz, originally hails from Spain after all. And while it is true that of late we have avoided sharing music, I have a clip here I wish to share.
By all means, projectionist. A memorable and sad tune, to say the least, my friend. Now, of course, we've had the occasion to talk about Rod Serling on the show numerous times. So, let's instead focus on the fantastic job director Jeanette Zwark did on this segment. I hope I'm not mangling his name too badly. This isn't the first Night Gallery segment that Zwark worked on. There were 19 in total, and a few highlights include Death in the Family, Last Rites for a Dead Druid, The Sins of the Fathers, and The Caterpillar. But Jeanette also directed feature films, including 1978's Jaws 2, and one of the greatest tragic love stories of all time, 1980's Somewhere in Time, with Christopher Reeve, Jane Seymour, and Christopher Plummer, adapted from a Richard Matheson novel, I should add, who is no stranger to Rod Serling's The Twilight Zone or The Night Gallery. Zwark has continued to direct, working on the likes of Ally McBeal, Smallville, Supernatural, Bones, and just recently 15 episodes of Grey's Anatomy. Considering that on Night Gallery, the budgets, as I understand it, for each segment were small, to put it kindly, Cool Air feels much bigger due to the way it was shot. Especially impressive as Swark and the rest of the cast and crew were able to successfully pull off a worthy Lovecraft adaptation. Speaking of, in the exceptional Rod Serling's Night Gallery and After Hours tour by Scott Skelton and Jim Benson, there is a quote from an interview with the director where he mentions chatting with Serling about how to approach taking an H.P. Lovecraft story and filming it, saying, quote, "I always kept saying that as it was written, Lovecraft is impossible to adapt because you can never find a visual equivalent of his style," recalls Swark. "I mean, he describes horror that chills your bones. It's the words and the way he manipulates the words. And you can't do that on film because film is almost too literal a form. An image is something concrete, and that's always the pitfall," end quote. I will, of course, provide a link to where you can pick up a copy of Rod Serling's Night Gallery and After Hours Tour. It is a book that should be in the library of any fan of Night Gallery. It really is an indispensable tome, containing interviews with those in front of and behind the camera, providing behind-the-scenes information as well as critical analysis of each segment of the series. Okay, I think it's about time we tackle the synopsis for Cool Air. As always, it will be filled with spoilers. If you want to check out the segment for yourself first, pause the podcast. It's available to watch for free on NBC.com right this second. We'll be here when you get back. And with that, I think the projectionist has a little audio treat for you listeners.
I most certainly do, Victor.
Miss Joan Crawford, Ossie Davis, Richard Kiley, Roddy McDowell, and Barry Sullivan, starring in the Night Gallery. I'm Rod Serling. I would like to invite you to join me for the telling of three stories represented in this gallery by these paintings, to be displayed here for the first time. Each is a collector's item in its own way, not because of any special artistic quality, but because each captures on a canvas, suspends in time and space, a a frozen moment in a nightmare.
My abiding concern, Doctor, and my singular preoccupation is myself. 11 hours or 12, fewer or more, it makes no difference. I want to see something. Trees, concrete, buildings, grass, airplanes, colors!
Alles in der Welt, Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles, über
alles. You look here, old man. Death is final. Death is it.
I think not, Mr. Jeremy. I think there are things stronger than death and more lasting than the grave.
Portafoy?
I think hate is stronger than death, Mr. Jeremy, and I think you're beginning to realize that.
Join me for the unveiling at the Night Gallery.
Friends, as I've said since we started Season 3 of the podcast, I'm doing my level best to shorten the length of each episode's synopsis.
And judging by your electronic missives, you are quite appreciative of this too.
Maybe I can convince Rockford to take my place as co-host. Instead of a projectionist, I could be a Cracker Jack concession attendant. Hey, have you tried our milk duds? For a quarter more, you can make it a large soda. I could probably handle that, right?
Hopefully better than you can thread a film, Sage.
I'll look back on this one day and laugh. Yeah, I'm sure I will. Cool Air was originally broadcast on the evening of December 8th of 1971. As the segment begins, we are introduced to the character of Agatha Howard, who, through a point-of-view shot, is slowly walking through a cemetery, towards a leaf-covered headstone, bending to place a bouquet of flowers next to it. Through narration, provided by Barbara Rush, who does a convincing enough job as portraying an elderly woman, we learn that this is a trek she makes once a year to honor the interred, which the headstone reveals was Dr. Juan Munoz.
Although one has to wonder where the communication broke down with whomever worked on said headstone, dear listeners, as Munoz is misspelled.
That is true, my friend. It also happens to be mentioned in Rod Serling's Night Gallery and After Hours tour. This stuff happens. Heck, I remember when I saw The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen in theaters. We had some audience members bust out laughing when a tombstone for a certain character was misspelled. Back on subject. Thanks to that narration by Rush, we are informed that Munoz passed away 50 years earlier. So she's probably in her 70s at this point in the story. There is quite a bit of pain in her narration, the feeling, as she puts it, as an obligation to bring flowers every year, and that with her age, she sometimes forgets not only what Juan looked like exactly, but even his voice. Which leads us to a flashback of when Agatha first met the late doctor in what I presume to be 1923.
There is an obstacle to overcome, though, before they have their first meeting. Mrs. Gibbons, the owner of the brownstone where Dr. Juan Munoz rents three of her rooms. It would appear that the landlady is something of a devotee to the style of the flappers.
Absolutely. Mrs. Gibbons was played by Beatrice Kay, who was a fairly well-known singer, and was not only a vaudevillian actor, but appeared on stage, and even worked with the likes of Orson Welles on his Mercury Theater on the Air series. She even had her own show in 1946, entitled The Beatrice Kay Show. We learn that Agatha Howard has traveled from Massachusetts to meet with Dr. Munoz, as her father, her late father, who was a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, were well acquainted with each other. Mrs. Gibbons would appear to not have the time to run up and down to the second floor landing with messages, as she pretty quickly lets Agatha in. The older woman, to me, acts very passive-aggressive, in my opinion, and it seems that the younger woman is equally less than pleased to have to deal with Gibbons.
Perhaps if Mrs. Gibbons were not to address Agatha Howard as sister, and in a disdainful tone of voice at that,
That would be a good start, although by the time they reach Dr. Munoz's room, the older woman seems to back off a little. For one thing, she doesn't think that Agatha is going to stay long. First, pointing out the smell coming from the doctor's rooms, which she explains to Howard is ammonia. Munoz has a machine that she reveals runs on it. It apparently leaks too, as well as being noisy enough to be heard throughout the brownstone. In fact, you can actually hear the machine running in the background, which Howard will quickly find out is an air conditioning system. A very cold one at that.
Dear listeners, as this is set in the early 1920s, the air conditioning system that keeps Dr. Juan Munoz's room, as Mrs. Gibbons states, cold as a grave, like a tomb, very much looks as if it was all hand-built, no doubt, by the doctor himself, yes.
That is probably true, projectionist. Although, even from the first meeting between the rather suave Dr. Munoz and Agatha, we can plainly see the machine is less than reliable. As beautiful as Barbara Rush is in Cool Air, Henry Darrow is equally handsome and charming. You can totally see why Agatha would find herself attracted to the doctor. His sitting room is also quite impressive. Objects of art, paintings and sculptures fill the room, as well as possessing a fantastic library. The reason being, as we will learn, is that Juan never, and I mean ever, leaves the brownstone. He explains he suffers from an illness that threatens his life if he were to experience temperatures over 55 degrees. So the three rooms he rents are beautiful and comfortable, but still very much a prison.
As we watched this earlier this week, I wondered if Dr. Juan Munoz leaves his room during the winter.
I suppose that is quite possible, but what about the brownstone hallways and foyer? Are they heated during the winter? He plainly states he cannot handle temperatures over 55 degrees. Now, the reason for Agatha's visit to Juan is not only to inform him of her father's passing earlier that year due to a heart attack, but the strange nature of her late father's correspondence with the doctor. Apparently, universities have requested Professor Howard's writings, and while going through them, to of course separate the more personal correspondence, Agatha was fascinated by the two learned men's letters to each other. The fact, as she says, they both didn't believe in death being irreversible. In a wonderful bit of acting by Darrow, you can tell he is more than surprised by Agatha by finding his research of interest. Professor Howard was studying how to restore failing organs by way of cellular research, with Munoz's studies bordering on, as he puts it, the mystic, harnessing the will itself to stave off death.
It is here where the giant refrigeration unit suddenly ceases to function, and the look of panic on Dr. Juan Munoz's face as he rushes to start it back up.
Yeah, he's definitely overcome with terror while trying to get the air conditioning unit going. Even with the obvious frigid temperatures of his room, Agatha wishes the opportunity to see him again, inquiring about dinner. Although, as Munoz never leaves his room, Howard, especially for the time, offers to dine with him in his apartments, considering it's 1923, a rather forward proposition.
Indeed. It is a request, however, that Dr. Juan Munoz gratefully accepts. Although, the reaction to his kissing of Agatha Howard's hand is interesting.
Well, it would seem that it's not just the room that is ice cold, right? Through a very clever set of montages showcasing the apartment itself, Janot Zwark not only conveys the passage of time, but with the narration of the older Howard, we see for ourselves why she falls for the doctor. He shares the history of his own country, including literature and art, and we learn as well that he was once married, but that his wife sadly died 10 years earlier, after he became afflicted with his strange illness. Although, during a dinner between the two, we found out that, like Dr. Munoz, his wife also believed passionately in his research. Although, as it turns out, perhaps not quite as strongly.
My wife. She believed, as I did, that you could forestall death defeated by strength of will.
She must have had an infinite faith.
Not quite infinite, I'm afraid. She committed suicide the year after my illness, which perhaps isn't as inconsistent as it sounds. Her faith in man had to do with her ability to survive, and her own free will to reject or accept death as she saw fit. And there have been times recently when I have found myself wondering.
Why ever would she have committed suicide, dear listeners?
I thought it was a nice touch in Serling's teleplay that one who is quite passionate about his theories and research has started to have doubts of his own. Time passes, and Agatha, with a sack full of groceries, calls on Dr. Munoz, only to find he won't answer the door. The city is experiencing a punishing heat wave. The doctor, almost whispering through the door to his apartments, begs her forgiveness and says he isn't feeling well. As she's about to leave, a violent thunderstorm appears to knock out the power to the brownstone.
That could be bad in keeping the apartments refrigerated, yes?
Not as bad as what occurs later that evening. Agatha is awoken by a telephone call from Juan, begging for her help. The air conditioning unit has totally died, and he can't locate a repairman to come to his rooms at 3 o'clock in the morning. After rushing to the brownstone, Munoz opens the door just a crack, and we can see he's dressed in a white robe, covering all but one eye. As it turns out, though, in the brownstone, in the apartment below Munoz, is an automobile mechanic. Thanks to Agatha's personal pleas for assistance, he agrees to take a look. Although, upon entering, the older man makes a mention about the overpowering smell in the room, which the doctor remarks is just incense.
The refrigeration unit, however, cannot be repaired.
Not until the early hours of the morning, at least. Juan begs help from Agatha once again, for her to find someone who would deliver ice to his rooms. And, as we learn moments later, she succeeds. A delivery man tells her out in the hallway that he's at least delivered 300 pounds of ice to the apartments, most of it in the bathroom where Munoz has locked himself. The young woman rushes to speak with Juan, and he sounds even worse now. Barely able to speak above a whisper, he informs her that his theories about postponing death through the power of his will proved only to be that, theories. You see, the illness he contracted 10 years earlier was the one we all eventually succumbed to, death. That is why his wife took her life, because how could she live with Juan? How might she be able to deal with his touch, etc., as he was a walking corpse? Due to the heat, his body is ravaged by time, as we in Agatha see for ourselves when she forces her way into the bathroom to begin screaming uncontrollably at the dissolving form, the withering corpse of the man she came to love that was Dr. Juan Munoz. You might find it interesting to know that in the original story, Dr. Munoz is decaying by the end of the tale, melting as the heat overtakes him, having just enough time to write a letter to his friend before he perishes. And the mental image of him just becoming a grotesque puddle of goo sticks with you. Well, it appears that for the Night Gallery adaptation of Cool Air, they attempted something similar, as Henry Darrow mentions in an interview in Rod Serling's Night Gallery and After Hours tour. They used makeup that was mixed with Alka-Seltzer. During a test, they squirted a bit of water on his face, and it naturally began to foam up and look like he was melting. It seems they were worried it might be too much for the censors, and decided to go with the withered form of his corpse on the bathroom floor. Although, I would add, it is no less shocking, especially with the pitch of Barbara Rush's screams. The segment ends where it began, at the cemetery, with a 70-year-old Howard narrating how, when she experiences Cool Air, it causes her to think of the horror of what she experienced, and what could have been. After all, if their love had continued to grow into something physical, the realization of what that would have meant, well, you get the picture. No wonder it fills her with dread even 50 years later. And as the sorrowful music provided by Robert Bain begins to end, we can see the leaves blown off the headstone, which reads Dr. Juan Munoz, born 1887, died 1913, and 1923. And that, friends, is the synopsis for the Night Gallery adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's Cool Air. As always, thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to the show, and we hope you're enjoying Season 3 so far. I know that for the third season, we always intended it to be a weekly show, but life, work on the house, and such managed to delay this particular episode for 3 weeks. You have my humble apologies for that. I am totally to blame. Although, I will say that we plan on making it up to you. So keep an eye out for the next Saturday Frights podcast. Sooner than you might think. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. My co-host, The Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He manages to share interesting trivia on films on a daily basis, or sometimes just vintage movie posters and behind-the-scenes photographs of some of your favorite films. I also want to thank Rockford J for putting up with the abuse of the projectionist on a nearly daily basis. I couldn't keep a lid on the vault without his hard work. He shares his own love of the horror genre every single day on the Saturday Frights Facebook page. As for myself, you can still find me posting on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page, and of course, the Pop Culture Retrorama site, too. Saturday Frights has an Instagram account, by the way, if you want to check it out. You can find it. It's simply Saturday_Frights. If you'd like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at vicsagepopculture@gmail.com. For all things pop culture and retro-related, feel free to visit us at the Pop Culture Retrorama site. Generally, we have something of interest to share a couple of times a day. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for originally hosting the podcast, but for allowing us for nearly 10 years to share our love of all things retro. If you like the show, consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes. Our past catalog of episodes are slowly coming back online, but you can still listen to the entire collection over on the Internet Archive. We are also available on Google Podcasts and Spotify, as well as Stitcher. As we end this show, why not listen to a clip from the film we'll be discussing in the near future?
I used to have a regular game back here with Gibbons and Norris and a bunch of the boys. They don't come around here anymore. I cleaned them all out. I guess they weren't used to my kind of competition.
You trying to tell me something, Sam?
Yeah, I am, Reno. I'm just reminding you. I'm the best. I wouldn't want you to forget that.
This has been a Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. Goodbye, and thanks for listening. The Saturday Frights podcast is not affiliated with or authorized by Universal, NBC, or any of the businesses and individuals that have been mentioned in the show. All music and sound clips are the property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purpose of review, criticism, and commentary only, and are not intended to infringe.
House rules, Doctor. When a young lady comes visiting, the door stays open.
Applicable when it is young men that the young ladies are visiting. Thank you.